You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
The cofferdam was huge. It spanned the entire middle section of the river, holding back the water to create a dry place, and into it men poured. From high on the hill, they were 1,000 fretting specks coursing over the site, 10,000 spires of rebar thrust up from the dam, their lower ends buried in concrete casings that were sunk to the bedrock. The length of the dam curved its back against the flow of the river as it spanned the channel. This would allow it to bear the weight of the water like a Roman arch. This is G.P. Gottlieb, and today I'm talking to Mark Barr, author of Watershed, his debut novel. An engineer with a troubling past finds work on a large federal dam project in rural Tennessee. He also finds a room in a boarding house run by a stern woman whose niece turns up after her husband gives her a sexually transmitted disease. They struggle to find their places. He by working extra hours to prove his engineering prowess. She by stepping away from her role as a housewife and into a job working for one of the other boarders. Their almost relationship in this gorgeous novel is set during a post-depression, mosquito-filled summer during which the advent of electricity forever changes the lives of rural America. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Khalid. Thanks so much for having me.
So how did you come up with the title for Watershed?
Well, I wrestled with it for quite a while. I tried other titles, and just I think in the end, what worked really well about Watershed was that it sort of has the two-fold sort of meaning. That it, you know, a watershed is kind of the sort of the drainage basin that sort of describes the area where all the sort of activity of the novel takes place. And then also there's the, you know, obviously, you know, this is describing a watershed moment in these people's lives.
Mm-hmm. So what was the genesis of the book?
I think I got the initial idea. I worked for a while in advertising, and we had a client that was an electric cooperative. And I was tasked with writing a brochure for it. And I had never heard of an electric cooperative, and I didn't know about the history of rural electrification, and it all kind of – so I uncovered a lot of that sort of in my research, and I was really struck that it seemed like such a big thing to me that we had this period of time in, you know, in our country's history where we had such a disparity in sort of the standards of living, and we just collectively have forgotten it. You know, it wasn't something that I certainly knew about growing up. And so I knew I wanted to set a story against that sort of backdrop.
How did you do the research for it?
Well, I did a lot of internet research. The government keeps a lot of records, and they there's a lot of great sort of online repositories you can get at. I did some research looking at maps. I did visit. I went to a town in western Tennessee where there is a dam that was built in 1937, and sort of, you know, got the lay of the land and sort of saw what kind of trees grow there and stuff like that. And then I also visited a dam. There was a dam in the town. I was living in Austin at the time, and there was a dam also built in 1937. And I was able to go tour that dam and sort of look at it up close and really sort of see, you know, and talk to a person who worked there about the stories he had heard about the construction of the dam.
Mm-hmm. So the geography of the place of the story setting is important. Why Tennessee and why this particular town outside of Memphis?
I think, you know, growing up as a, you know, a Southerner or loving Southern fiction, Faulkner sort of was always, you know, loomed really large in my thinking. And I think in so many of his novels, you know, Memphis is that sort of big city that everyone aspires to go to. So I knew Memphis was important. But I also knew, I mean, I guess I came to Tennessee quite naturally in that I was interested in writing about rural electrification. And I knew there would be a hydroelectric dam, and Tennessee with the Tennessee Valley Authority was just, you know, replete with dams. I mean, I can't remember, they're like 12 or 15 they built, you know, in just during that time period. And I knew that Tennessee would just fit really well.
Huh. So let's talk about the characters. What drew you to a character like Claire?
You know, I think Claire is definitely sort of the main character of the book, but she wasn't initially. Initially, Nathan was sort of my guy. I guess it just came out of, you know, I knew if Nathan was an outsider, I needed someone who was local as a counterpoint. And that's where Claire came from. And then she surprised me by sort of growing into the main character. She just, her story, her, you know, became kind of the main arc that I felt like sort of described the novel.
Yeah. And then what about her mother? She has a cameo appearances, but she's really important.
Right. I don't know. I think, you know, again, just so much of, so many of the details in the novel are about, you know, I think from just a storytelling point of view, I knew she would be facing, like any of us, anyone who tries to, she's growing, right? And she's changing. And in any, I think in every person's life, when we do that, the people around us who've known us in one way or another, that there are people who try to, who don't want us to change. I mean, and that comes out of some basic psychology of like, they understand us and they don't want us to, you know, change from what they know. And so I was thinking about who would be those people, and her mother seemed, you know, sort of occurred to me as someone who would definitely try to enforce those traditional roles back on her, even as she tried to, you know, grow beyond them.
So is there anything good about Claire's husband?
I think, you know, everyone's got their good qualities. I felt for me, what defined Travis was his ambition. I mean, that's how I thought about him. He has shortcomings, and that, you know, that sort of makes him sort of a less desirable person. But ultimately, I mean, I think anyone could feel some, empathy for, he's just wanting to, he has a dissatisfaction with his life and he's trying to improve it. And unfortunately, that leads him to have dissatisfaction in his marriage and some other, you know, some other areas that he needs to maybe be working harder to improve rather than sort of escape. But I feel like ultimately he's, you know, whether it's reading or, you know, tying a tie or just, you know, he's always about trying to grow.
Yeah, but I hated him. He's a monkhead.
Well, yeah.
He cheated on Claire.
Right. Oh, no. Yeah, he's certainly got a lot of problems. Certainly.
So why did you decide to give beer and moonshine such a big role in the story? Let's talk about beer and moonshine.
Yeah. I don't know. I just tried to think. I mean, as I imagined, a group of people who have traveled for work and are, you know, they're living someplace where they don't have their families and their sort of, you know, the things that I'm trying to think how to put it, like they don't have their usual structures, you know, family and friends and stuff. I felt like what happens a lot is people that, you know, they're trying to find new ways to socialize, and so often drinking you know, comes up in that. I don't know. I just, it seemed like a natural sort of fit.
Yeah. Another big theme, two big themes are this contrast between fire and water. So water is with the dam, but then a fire takes place before the action of the book.
Right, right.
And it's caused by a janitor who tries to do a cheap fix on something. And there's a lot in your book about quality versus expediency.
Yeah, yeah.
What can you tell us about? I don't want to give anything away, but can you? What can you talk? Can you talk a little bit about the fire and or using inexpensive things when something better has been done?
I mean, I think that's I think it's the case in a lot of a lot of things in our world that there's the right way to do things and there's the quick way to do them. And yeah, and that's what definitely, the fire, you know, comes out of someone taking shortcuts and, you know, and sets everything in motion. It is interesting. I didn't explicitly, you know, set out to sort of have counterpoints of fire and water, but it works pretty nicely, you know, when I think about it.
I didn't understand this. The janitor does a cheap fix, right? And there's a fire and people are killed in that fire.
Right.
I don't understand why the blame fell on the building's architects and engineers. Why didn't the blame fall squarely on the person who caused it?
Right. Well, I think we see this sometimes in society where, you know, something bad happens and we need scapegoats, and I'm not saying it's right, but I think we desire, someone to blame. And my sort of thinking in the story was that the janitor was simply too small and inconsequential. For me, what was interesting was trying to work out the way is to sort of look at the way scandal works and the way it can grow and even migrate some. And so I as another reader of the book, I kind of felt like Nathan wasn't explicitly to blame for what happened, but like he says, when he's talking to Claire there, and then about 2/3 through the book, he says, like, I wasn't guilty, but I feel like maybe I have become guilty. You know, it's like there's sort of just because I'm trying to think how to say it. It's like there's a migration of blame in that you may not be explicitly to blame for that initial act, but we're all guilty of something. And if you dig enough, there's going to be degrees of guilt and there's degrees of culpability. And so for Nathan, it sort of unraveled a lot. I mean, so he was guilty of having too much ambition, perhaps. And so he's sort of paying the price for that.
But I also respected that he basically said the buck stops here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think it comes down to something like that, I think.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So what else can you tell us about Nathan and his challenges?
Well, I mean, I mean, with Nathan, I was very interested in it when I was growing up. I'll just tell you a story. When I was growing up, there was a story in my family about a great uncle of mine. He was my grandparent. I think my grandfather had 9 siblings, and a lot of them are quite older. And so he had a brother who had moved away and was working. He had a rented room in another town, and something happened, and he took his own life. And it was never clear in the family. It was like by the time I heard the story, it was never clear why. But there were just hints that there'd been a scandal, that there'd been mm-hmm. something, whether it was a pregnancy or some financial impropriety or what. It wasn't really clear. And as a young man, it just really, what struck me was that there had been a time when your good name mattered that much, and that mm-hmm. the loss of it could drive you to something like that. And so Nathan, if more than anything else, Nathan embodied that. I was trying to sort of explore what it would be like for someone who was, it was very ambitious, maybe a bit precocious in his, in his youthful accomplishments, but then to be undone in that way and to lose his good name, and how he might, handle it, and how he might try to flee it, but ultimately have to go back and confront it.
Yeah. So Nathan's bosses, can we discuss Fitzsimmons and Mofray?
Yeah. I mean, so they are, Mofray's he is the engineer's engineer. He's the person, he's the one you'll read about in the history books. They describe Fitzsimmons as his hammer. He's, mm-hmm. he's the person who, he makes sure that the work gets done. I think in the book, so at times Mofray can be kind of come off as the one of high ideals and a bit more lofty, but I think they work, hand in glove, sort of. Though Fitzsimmons obviously is, more of the, he's not a villain, but he's definitely an antagonist to Nathan and the other men of the office.
What interested you about the party at Mofray's home?
It gave me an opportunity, one, to look at, to sort of bring, however briefly, Mofray's wife into the picture, because I thought it'd be interesting to imagine the sort of partner a man like this might have, given the time frame and given, the work he's doing. Because any of these, particularly, I'm just talking about men here, but any of these figures in history that we've seen, they clearly had partners. I mean, they were not doing all these things in a vacuum. They had, they had support systems. They had people who were counseling them, in the evening or shoring up the other parts of their life so they could excel in some of these ways. And so I was interested in kind of bringing her in, even briefly. And then it was just sort of fun to think about because the office is so driven and it's so one kind of pressure, and I think how that might flip and become a different sort of pressure in a social setting.
What is the purpose? What was your idea about telling the side stories about Nathan's colleagues?
Do you mean like with Clark and some of the
stuff
they're doing?
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of what I do in the book is trying to sort of, I feel like I'm trying to write about a society. Whenever possible, I try to have sort of, hopefully not too large, but digressions into sort of to explore some of these side characters who give us slightly different, slightly different perspectives on what's going on, or slightly different, they have slightly different goals than Nathan, but they're all sort of all pulling in the same traces. I just like to, it sort of like gives color to the story, I felt like.
Yeah, it did. I loved that you have all these strong women.
Yeah.
The women really stand out. Aunt Irma, for example.
Right.
She's
right.
A character.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's always been strong women. I think we just have not been great about always writing about them or depicting them. And I mean, I certainly had strong women in my life, so it was a natural, thing to do.
I liked how Aunt Irma had these rules in her boarding house, and she says only two of them, but she was pretty strict.
Yeah. Although they do get broken, there's consequences.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the other boarders with Nathan?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was a fun part to write, sort of thinking about who this sort of menagerie of working men who are all sort of, uprooted from where they normally are. They're all chasing work. And these are the ones who are doing really well. You know, the guys in the boarding house are sort of all fairly white collar, and they're from different places. They have different personalities. And I liked sort of exploring, how they might interact or, what a conversation might feel like at a dinner table with all these different people. And then because Nathan is only a lot of the novel is about that world of men and how Nathan's trying to find his place in it.
What does the redheaded boy signify, and why is what interested you about his story?
Yeah, I think what a lot of my writing's about is about societies in communities as they change, I was interested in rural electrification and the way this community changed. The way I chose to implement that, ultimately, I needed Claire and Nathan, and they're pursuing their own stories that have certain dramatic needs and results. But I needed something. I needed some sort of character to sort of help me see, to sort of be the everyman, or to give me, I needed this family of the red-haired boy, sort of the voice of it, to kind of show, to give me occasionally an opportunity to step back and show like how the larger community was handling certain issues, because there are people, because as with anything, whether it's cell phones or, any new technology, there are going to be people who rush to embrace it, and they're going to be people who resist at all costs. And I wanted to kind of think about that. And so the red-haired boy and his family just sort of gave me a way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I looked you up when I first got your name.
Yeah.
First found your book. And you have quite a lot of responses, quite a lot of reviews online. And a bunch of them asked, are you going to do a follow-up? Are we going to find out what happened to Claire and Nathan? It was pretty funny. People don't usually ask those kind of questions.
Yeah. I was surprised by that as well. I mean,
so.
I didn't set out with a purposely to be obscure. I think I was trying really hard to sort of walk that line between having a fresh sort of ending to the book, without falling into sort of something that's a little too familiar. And I think, but in that process, I'm not overly explicit about some things like Nathan and where he ends up. I mean, I have my opinions about where he's going, and I didn't plan on writing something more, but I don't know. Maybe that's in the works somewhere down the road.
Maybe your fans will put enough pressure on you.
Right.
You'll have to.
Yeah. I'm touched that people thought that and were interested to ask that sort of thing. It's not actually something I'm actively planning. I have a couple projects. I'm sort of, that I've got sort of that are in mid progress. The one that I'm kind of leaning toward at the moment is again a community as it changes, and it's set a little, but it's also, and it's a little in the past. It's set in the late 80s, early 90s in a coal mining community in southern Illinois. and just as it's a, so it's a community as the coal mining sort of, it's, there's kind of two generations, and you're seeing as coal mining, as the mines are closing, you get some parts of the story that are dealing with when the mines are open, and then you're dealing with the younger generation after they've closed. And there's, you know, it's a bit more of a crime novel. There's meth manufacturing involved. But also, there's a healthy dose of film. I don't know. I like movies, and I there's something really attractive to me about cinematic, all things cinematic. And so there's an aspiring filmmaker, and it's sort of, so it's something I'm exploring still.
Okay. I hope the aspiring filmmaker is not stuck in Southern Illinois. That's personal.
That's right. I forgot you were in Chicago, right? So.
Mark, it was great talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing your answers and talking about this book. I really did. It was such a juicy novel. I hope lots of people, I'm going to share it with lots of people.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking with you, and thanks for your questions. It's been a lot of fun.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host of New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Mark Barr, author of Watershed. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Books Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle is an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As NBN listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/NBN/join.